have a bit of a meander through some of the history of US imperialism. I wanted to start with you, Ashley. The notion of empire, let's try and define our terms, or at least get us all on the same page so we know what we're talking about. This notion empire, when I do a word association, the first words that come into my mind when I hear the word empire are Roman, Ottoman, British, and it usually get a picture of something that is related to geographical conquest, expansionism, pictures of maps where you can see something in the middle approximating empire, or in the case of the colonial period in the British, where, you know, you can see Britain there is in, you know, maybe it's yellow or blue. And then you look to Africa and you see bits of Africa that are yellow, so you know England's ruling those parts. Bit in Asia, there's yellow there, you know Britain's ruling that. Something's pink, that might be Portuguese, or it might be the Dutch, etc. But empire, generally thought of or conceived, it seems to be associated with some sort of territorial conquest and geographical, you know, you can see it on the map, so to speak. The US empire has had some of that in its history, the Philippines, obviously, in the first half of the 20th century, but it really hasn't been the way that the United States has exercised its power in general, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century. Can you maybe say a few words about what we mean by US empire? What is it, and how does the US have its power if it's separate to previous empires or exercised differently?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, because if you think about empire, that you have those common sense associations and you think of, you know, ancient Rome or ancient China or whatever it may be, and it is all about geographical conquest. And I think U.S. imperialism is distinct and different for several reasons. First and foremost, the U.S. is a late developing imperialist power in the 19th century. It really didn't become a major player in global politics until really the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And if you think about that period, much of the world had already been divided up among the great powers of Europe, massive colonial empires that stretched all over Asia and Africa, with dependencies in Latin America that were already claimed by the existing powers. And the big development at the end of the 19th century was not only the rise of the U.S. as a gigantic economic force, but the rise of other similar powers in the rest of the world, Germany, Japan, that is late developing imperial powers that were capitalist in nature and corresponded to the logic of capitalist development. As soon as you have capitalist development, those powers that are experiencing that development break beyond their national boundaries and look to the world market for resources, markets to invest in, markets to sell their commodities, sources of cheap labor. And when you have these late developing imperial powers develop within an already divided world that has these giant colonial empires, they bump up against it. So Germany and Japan bump up against the existing imperial colonial structures in the world, and so does the United States. And the United States always positioned itself as an anti-imperial power. It's one of the great ironies of U.S. imperialism. It's always masqueraded as actually opposed to colonialism, opposed to state domination of countries throughout the world. And so it had a strategy of prying open the existing imperial colonial structures so that it could get access to those things that it was closed off from. That is the markets of former colonies of Europe, the cheap labor sources, et cetera. So the world had already been divided up, and the US, Germany, and Japan rose and wanted to redivide the world. And the US developed a strategy of the open door from the early stages of its imperial project, that it wanted to pry open the closed doors of Asia, pry open the closed doors of Europe, pry open the closed doors of Latin America and the Caribbean, pry open the closed doors of Africa, not because they were doing it for national liberation purposes, but for obviously predatory reasons. They wanted the market so that they could rake in the profits. And the U.S. military, along with its commercial strength, was used to pry open those markets. So you had commercial development expanding, you had geopolitical assertion by the United States, and then it was backed up by the military might of the U.S. And obviously that culminated in the giant wars of the 20th century, which was the final battle for the redivision of the world, in which the U.S. came out on top, always posturing as an anti-colonial power, but thoroughly imperialist in its very nature.
So we have a different style of empire based on what you're saying, the open door here. But we also get a Cold War in the middle part of the 20th century, quite early on, where bloc politics comes to dominate. Well, is the US policy in that period, is it operating exactly the same way as it did prior to the First World War? Or are we starting to see, like, with the open door, how is the door becoming half closed, I guess is one way of putting it. How much of the world is up for grabs, and how is the US exercising its power in a period where, you know, arguably you have dual polarity. You have the rise of this competitor in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, particularly after the Second World War. How does that change the dynamics of the way the US is exerting itself, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that's another great question. When you think about it, the world that I was describing, that the US became an imperialist power within, it was a multipolar world system. And there you had many great powers angling for the dominance of the world economy, and the final arbiter of that struggle was the cataclysmic battles of World War I and World War II. After two things that happened that are important before the Cold War. First, the giant Great Depression, which led much of the world economy to retreat from the internationalization of the system with protectionist policies and a retreat from the scale of interconnection of the world economies. So you had real retreat. So the high point of internationalization of the system was in the early 20th century and now today. Those are the high points. But in the period after the Great Depression, you had a retreat from that internationalization. And that was compounded when you had the development of the Cold War with the Stalinist states of Eastern Europe and Russia, and then later China, which were carved out of the world economy as autarkic state capitalist regimes that were not trading and investing in the rest of the world economy. And on the other side, you had the Cold War bloc that the U.S. ran, which was interconnected economically, but the U.S. was more concerned about overseeing a network of rivals in their Cold War battle with Stalin's Russia. And so you didn't have the same scale of openness of the world system, but geopolitically, there was a great deal of collaboration between the states of the Western bloc, of the U.S. bloc of the Cold War. But the U.S. was, especially its corporations, were beginning the process of globalization within its bloc prior to the end of this Cold War period. So there were already dynamics independent of state policy of globalization that were beginning to develop, especially in the 1960s.
It's through this period. So you've gone, as you know, multipolarity, you say, then to sort of the Cold War, we've got two poles, or possibly three with the Third World, which doesn't really play this independent role. But also the beginnings, really from the Second World War, the beginnings of the construction of this architecture around the world of the free, the globalization, as you say, which entails a number of free trade treaties, but also the institutions of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the later the World Trade Organization, all becoming arbiters of the way and the how and the who of global trade and finance. One writer, his name escapes me now, but I'm sure you'll remember him, he talks about the Dollar Wall Street regime and the rise of a particular form of US power, which basically the power of the financial markets, which seems still to have a legacy, I'm sure we'll get to. But how exactly, when you're thinking through these different aspects of power and empire, territorial power, political power, economic power, military power, the financial power of the United States becomes sort of unparalleled. And its domination of these the institutions which provide the architecture of trade and finance, the rules of the game, et cetera. How is there a dramatic shift in this period? Does it alter? Is this one of the reasons that the US comes out victorious at the end of the Cold War? And what sort of legacy are we looking at with these large organisations that are setting, as I say again, the architecture of the world economic system?
Yeah, that forces us to go into greater detail about what the U.S. strategy was in the Cold War period, which was definitely the economic, political, and institutional integration of its bloc of the Cold War. And it set up all sorts of things, like you named them, the architecture of the world financial system, the world trading system, and the world political system. That is, it set up the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which shaped the policies of the Western bloc and increasingly opened the economies of the Western bloc. And that would eventually morph into the World Trade Organization after the end of the Cold War. It also set up the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, which it dominated almost entirely and used its currency through those institutions to set the terms of how borrowing and lending were done in the world system. And then, of course, the U.S. had hoped for a long time through the World War II period to set up an international political institution, that is what would become the United Nations, as a way to cohere the world system. But of course, that was blocked by the division of the world system into the two Cold War poles. So that was stymied as a vehicle for U.S. imperialism, especially in the Cold War period. But after the Cold War, it becomes increasingly important as a means to exert U.S. power in the world system. And throughout, I think in the Western bloc, it's important to understand the importance of the dollar. That is, the dollar becomes the world reserve currency as a result of the triumph of American capitalism in the Western bloc. It's the main currency that all the states in the world system use as a reference point for their trading, for their investments, and it becomes the vehicle, especially through the international financial institutions, for how the big states get their loans and balance their currencies. But in the Cold War period, especially up till the early 1970s, the U.S. dollar is pegged to the value of gold. And so you have a different architecture that changes dramatically in the 1970s that I'm sure we'll get into with the development of a new regime of accumulation, what Peter Gowan, who you referred to, calls the Dollar Wall Street regime.
Well, skipping ahead a little bit, we get multipolarity to the Cold War duality, to the period that's been described as unipolarity after the collapse of the Soviet Union. One conservative commentator, Charles Krauthammer, wrote at the time in the 90s that he sort of thought that unipolarity was only ever going to last so long, at best maybe four decades, or I think in his words, if the US ran its economy into the ground, then maybe it could only expect one. We're clearly moving beyond that moment, but what do you think the feature, well, at the time it was George H.W. Bush was the president, and they spoke of a new world order, basically the United States as the global police and the enforcer of the international regime. It was always a bit precarious, though, wasn't it? On the one hand, in a dynamic competitive capitalist system, there's always going to be challenges rising as different spheres of the globe become accumulators of wealth and investment. And on the other hand, there's, I guess, a more just realistic assessment of the nature of US leadership in the Cold War. Like, it's pretty clear that a lot of the countries that the United States sought to lead and led quite effectively were prepared to be led because they had a common enemy in the Soviet Union. So you had a willing coalition of Western forces all united against the so-called communist enemy. But in the period of US unipolarity, a lot of these Western countries no longer really felt, maybe in the 90s there was a bit of just uncertainty about what lay ahead, but clearly by the beginning of the 21st century, a lot of the Western countries had already begun to, in a sense, see themselves as acting more independently, particularly in Europe. I'm reminded of the fateful invasion of Iraq led by George H.W. Bush's son. In the beginning of that, it's Donald Rumsfeld. I'm not sure what position he held, if he was the Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense, but he was lambasting old Europe, basically Western Europe, for not getting on board. The United States could only bring, I think, Australia, United Kingdom, Poland, in terms of armed forces with them, and the rest of Europe was denounced as old, antiquated. They're just, you know, they eat dark chocolate. Their cheese is too runny. Their films are black and white and slow. These people are just of the past. They're not the future. So even without there being a major crisis in US imperialism, there's sort of a crisis of leadership, because there's not really a sense of what the leadership now is designed to achieve, or at least what it's going to benefit these other countries, which had previously been quite firmly under the wing of US imperialism, right?
Right, right. Well, I think the first thing to say about it is there's no such thing as a stable imperial order under capitalism. And I think that's important, because people often have a kind of misconception that, oh, the US is dominant, it's going to stay dominant for all time. Like Britain thought it was going to rule the waves for here to eternity. And the reality is that capitalism, like you say, is a dynamic, competitive system. And it's also a crisis-ridden system, and the dynamics of competition and crisis can upset the existing balance of capitalist economic power and enable new powers, new centers of capital accumulation to come into being. And with that, aspirations for projection of its own corporate and state power into the world system against the old rivals. And the old rivals can atrophy as a result of their lagging behind in the competitive race of the world system. So you have a whole sequence of orders: classical imperialism, the multipolar world order, the Cold War bipolar world order, and then you've got that unipolar moment after the end of the Cold War, in which you do have this situation: what is the world order going to be like? And in the 1970s, the U.S. faced a dry run of this problem within its own bloc, where it looked like, after the U.S. defeat in Vietnam, after the deep economic crisis that the U.S. and all of Western capitalism went into, and after the rise of Japan and Germany as potential competitors to the United States, the U.S. Developed this dollar Wall Street regime precisely to lock in the rest of the world's powers under its wing. That is, that it abandoned the gold standard, it maintained the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, and it weaponized the IMF and the World Bank as the mechanisms for granting loans to the developing world, to the global South, the third world, whatever vocabulary you want to use, and also to the rest of the advanced capitalist states in exchange with the promise that there would be a new boom. So it really came up with a neoliberal strategy of free trade globalization as a solution to the crisis of its imperial power and its economic crisis in the 1970s. And then when you fast forward to the 1990s, they wanted to generalize that dramatically to the entire world, with the promise that under the aegis of the United States, you'd have a massive global expansion. That was their public relations operation. But it also partially worked. We did have a long neoliberal boom from the early 1980s all the way up to 2008, and a big expansion of the world economy. And through that process of internationalization of the system, the U.S. protected its piece of the pie. It retained its currency as the global reserve, dictated to the developing world that it had to open up to accept American investment and exports and subordinate their economies, did the same to Europe, and increasingly gobbled up sections of the former Soviet bloc into its wing. So the U.S. managed in the period of the 1990s to oversee this global neoliberal expansion, but with huge crisis tendencies built into it. That is, when you have the opening up of the world financial system, you unleash dynamics of speculative bubbles and gigantic economic crashes. So really, since this neoliberal period, we've had a whole series of economic collapses. In 1980s, you had the savings and loan catastrophe. In the early 90s, you had, in Latin America, you had a massive debt crisis throughout the 1980s, similar debt crisis that happens in Mexico in the early 1990s, the Asian financial crisis, then the great financial crisis of 2007-2008, which produces the Great Recession and global slump that we're in the middle of. So their regime, the dollar Wall Street regime that they built, protected their control of the world financial trading economic system and therefore its imperial dominance, but also unleashed dynamics of crisis that are coming back to haunt it. And the other byproduct of this is, with the internationalization of the system, they uncorked the logic of new centers of capital accumulation coming into being. The most obvious being China, which went from an economic backwater cut out from the rest of the world economy in the 1960s to now the workshop of the world and a potential rival to the United States. So any kind of sense that the unipolar moment would be the end of history and we'd only have American imperialism and free market globalization from here to eternity and the promise of democracy going along with it has been blown up before our eyes, especially since the Great Recession.
Okay, so by your telling then here, what we have is an incredibly confident U.S. establishment with the promise of unipolarity, the promise of global supremacy through the export or the expansion of this model of accumulation throughout the 90s, but the model being inherently unstable, beset with contradictions that are eventually going to come back, and probably sooner, well, as we know now, sooner rather than later, it's going to come back and bite quite hard against its own architects. How does in this period of confidence, I guess, if that's what the 90s is for the US establishment, tremendous confidence coming out with the New World Order, how does the war in Iraq fit into this? I bring that up because, as I mentioned at the start, Ashley has been here before, and at that time we were talking about the crisis of US imperialism. And I think really people began talking about the crisis of US imperialism really from about 2000 and possibly even late 2003, or at least early 2004, when it became clear that the invasion of Iraq was not only an absolute disaster for the people whose country had been occupied and the millions of people displaced and killed by this vicious war machine, but it was becoming quite clear that this was a massive overreach on the part of US imperialism and something that it was going to take a long time to recover from. Why exactly, given the confidence of the US ruling class at achieving global supremacy through the globalization agenda, what was the meaning of this invasion, which has, in hindsight now, been one of the two fundamental undermining episodes of the US empire in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think the key thing to understand is the hubris of dominance that developed, especially in the US ruling class, and their determination to fend off what they most feared, which was a peer competitor that had independent access to especially the strategic oil reserves of the Middle East. And if you read the national security strategy documents of the Clinton administration towards its end, and especially Bush the Younger, Bush II, it's very clear, especially under Bush the Second, a growing concern about a potential challenge from China and a recalcitrant Russia that was no longer willing to go along with the shock therapy that had reduced Russia to rubble after the end of the Cold War, all the neoliberal policies that devastated Russian society. And so already you begin to see the Bush administration thinking, well, we're at the peak of our power, but there's been this long expansion. China is coming online. The Bush administration, for the first time, labels China a strategic competitor. And then they see an opportunity in after 9/11, which, as sick as that is, they saw it as an opportunity to lock in their position of dominance with military intervention in the Middle East. And that wasn't for access to oil for the United States, because the U.S. was not at that moment dependent on Middle Eastern oil. It was to control the spigot of oil that fueled the rest of the world economy, Europe, Japan, China, et cetera. So the U.S. wager was that if they could lock in control of the Middle East, remake it under its aegis, it would establish itself as a dominant power that wouldn't face rivalry. Because you can blackmail the economies of the world if you control the spigot of oil. So Afghanistan was a stepping stone to their real prize, which was Iraq, the strategic oil reserves in Iraq. But not just Iraq. Their plan was rolling regime change throughout the entire region to set up governments under the aegis of the United States that would be beholden to U.S. imperialism, finishing all sorts of problems from national liberation struggles and Cold War divisions that had kept a bunch of states outside the U.S. orbit. Obviously, that blew up in its face, and the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan faced the biggest strategic defeat in its history, really greater than Vietnam, when you look at its impact on the position of U.S. imperialism, because the U.S. really quickly recovered from its defeat in Vietnam and reasserted its power within a decade. And since Iraq, you've had an acceleration of the patterns of multipolarity and the development of a real rival. So instead of controlling the spigot of oil, they got bogged down in endless counterinsurgency warfare in the region, while China continued its expansion, while Russia became increasingly assertive of its interests, while the European Union got increasingly frustrated with U.S. imperial policy. And you had all sorts of regional powers become increasingly assertive in the world system. And behind the back of the U.S., as it was involved in all this counterinsurgency warfare in the Middle East, China made more and more deals through the very institutions that the U.S. had set up, the World Trade Organization, that it had hoped, the U.S. had hoped, would work in its interest. But now China was using it to exert its economic interests and its increasing imperial ambitions of its own. So yeah, I think that the Iraq war was a result of the hubris and a strategic plan to remake the Middle East in the interests of the United States and against the interests of the rest of the world's main great, great powers. But it blew up in its face. And then that combined with the Great Recession really have led to the relative decline of American imperialism and the end of the unipolar moment. You can't really say we're in a unipolar order right now. I think I call it an asymmetric multipolar world order. The U.S. remains absolutely dominant, but it faces now a new rival in the form of China and lesser rivals like Russia, which plays an outsized role because of its nuclear stockpile, and other states in different parts of the world that are regional powers. So you no longer have this situation of unrivaled U.S. dominance, precisely because of the imperial overreach and the economic crisis that has brought into being the end of the unipolar moment and the rise of this new asymmetric multipolar world order.
Would it also be correct, Ashley, to say that, because you mentioned at the start, the U.S. had an open door policy, you know, at the very beginning of its rise to being a late-coming imperial power. Has the U.S. been open-doored by China in the 21st century? Is that a big part of, you know, you mentioned the crises of the failed invasions in the Middle East, the crisis that results from the collapse of the financial system in 2007 to 2009, but China, the so-called communist state, has really thrived through policies that have been, well, now increasingly militaristic. But it thrived in a period where it wasn't really focused on its own military the way the United States was, and it was really doing all the door opening in this period mm-hmm. of the 21st century, right?
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, part of the accession of China to the World Trade Organization was its opening up and the rest of the world opening up to Chinese products. And you really have one of the most peculiar developments in the system of imperialism, where the big advanced capitalist powers invest heavily in China through subcontracting to various corporations that run giant factories within China. So you have the integration of the advanced capitalist countries with China, which at that point was an underdeveloped country, a backward economic power, but had an enormous labor force that the Chinese police state maintained an absolute subservience to the interests of global capitalism. But the Chinese state was very smart in terms of state capitalist planning. They maintained a monopoly on the strategic centers of capital accumulation, opened up to global investment, but then said to all the powers and corporations coming in, you had to pair with Chinese capital so that China could develop its own capitalist capacities, with the plan from the very beginning that they wanted to develop their own indigenous private and state capital that could rival the advanced capitalist countries on their own terms. That is, there was a plan from the very beginning on the part of the Chinese state, you know, however underdeveloped or publicly articulated, that they wanted to retain their status as a great imperial power. That was very clear from the very beginning. So they took advantage of the opening of the world economy and their own opening of their own economy to the advantage of its state capital and private capital. So now you've got the main manufacturing power in the world is in China, with state ownership of whole chunks of the economy and new private Chinese capital that is not just sweated labor capital, but corporations like Huawei that can challenge high-tech capital of a Western variety. And that's why there's been such a sharp battle around 5G technology and all the other high-tech areas, because the Chinese state has invested in research and development in national champions like Huawei that can compete in the world system. So in a sense, like you know, the end of the 19th century, when the United States rose as a world power, it wanted a piece of the action. It got in the action and worked the world system to rise as a power in its own right. And now we have China managing to do the same thing within an architecture that was set up by the U.S. That's why this is such a peculiar crisis for U.S. imperialism, because it undermines the free trade globalization logic that it had developed to begin with and institutionalized through the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and World Bank, and through all sorts of economic treaties between the great economic powers of the system. So, yeah, this is an unintended consequence of the very project that the U.S. had been engaged in.
Okay, so let's just quickly step through some of this again so we keep our eyes on the prize here and bring ourselves to the present and that question at hand. So as you've outlined for us, we've gone from a multipolar world order in the beginning, the early 19th century. We go to a bipolar world order where the US is hegemonic among a Western alliance against the Soviet Union. We see the collapse of that order into a moment of unipolarity, which the United States leaders at the time called the New World Order. We've seen a reconfiguration with the rise of China and the relative decline of the US into something you're terming an asymmetric multipolar world order. And now we go into, well, it's a new moment in a sense, the America First moment of the Trump administration, which at the time was sort of rubbish. His entire approach to world affairs was written off by the national security establishment and pretty much most of the ruling class in the United States in 2015, 2016. The first national security strategy under his administration pivots away from the old, the question of the war on terror style threats and very much puts geopolitical rivals back at the center of the stage. Although you mentioned that George W. Bush had already done this with China in the early 21st century. But Trump really puts China at the center of his...
That's right.
Yeah, the foreign policy adversary or the foreign adversaries or the great challenge of the United States. How much... because we've got Biden now as well. I get a sense that some of the stuff that was written off in the early Trump years as madness, lunacy, the work of a foreign policy illiterate, has actually turned out to feel as though maybe Trump, as a strategist, for want of a better word, of U.S. imperialism, has turned out to be possibly a little bit more far-sighted than people were prepared to give him credit for, just by virtue of a lot of the policies, the posturing, that he initiated being pretty much carried on and emulated in other parts of the world. And I don't mean simply the emulation that you see from someone like Bolsonaro in Brazil, really emulating just the far-right politics and theatre of the administration, but sort of everywhere, a rethinking of the idea of strategic manufacturing, of reshoring, of providing national security for the capitalist establishment through not having so many exposed supply chains running through this, through East Asia, where this new behemoth rival is rising that many of the ruling classes are now having second thoughts about their relationships with in a number of fronts. What's your take on this America First moment? It was it fleeting, or do you think it's enduring, or is it unclear where we're the waters that we're now charting?
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question, because it gets you to deal with the real dynamics of the world system today. I think you have to see it as a developmental process that really begins under the Obama administration, because the U.S. State Department and the foreign policy elite, the foreign policy bureaucrats, the foreign policy intellectuals, they really begin honing in on the reality that the U.S. is now at risk of facing a peer competitor. And Hillary Clinton, is very smart. And she writes a piece that was originally written in Foreign Policy magazine entitled The Pivot to Asia, in which she recognizes, and she says it very bluntly, you can't get tough with your own banker. That is, the Chinese state is now a holder of vast dollar holdings because of the trade deficit that the U.S. runs with China. So it has huge funds from the U.S. in its banks. And China is very confident as a result that it can dictate the terms of a geopolitical relationship and a trade relationship and a global economic relationship. So Hillary Clinton identifies this as a problem. Her strategy is still within the old neoliberal one of saying, we're going to bandwagon everybody together and get all the powers of the world to work through the World Trade Organization. We are going to pressure China to adhere to the rules so that those rules, which are set up to benefit the U.S. to the detriment of China, even though China is using them, and then we're going to move the U.S. military to Asia, deploy 60% of the U.S. Navy to the waters of the Pacific. So there's a recognition under the Obama administration that they have to do something, but they're unable to carry it out. They can't carry out the pivot to Asia in the political and economic and military senses. Politically, they can't carry it out because they're bogged down dealing with metastasizing crisis for their domination in the Middle East. That is not only the ongoing counterinsurgency warfare in Iraq, but also the Arab Spring that threatens their whole architecture of the Middle East, all the regimes that it's used to dominate the region for decades. And then on top of that, the rise of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. So it bogs the U.S. down both politically and militarily in an ongoing counterinsurgency warfare. And then it can't move its military because it's got to stay focused on completing the consequences, the catastrophe in Iraq. So really the U.S. elite recognize that there's a problem. They try one solution. Also, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is their big economic plan that Obama really started under Bush, but really reached its apogee under Obama, that falls through the cracks, doesn't even get through Congress. So the whole pivot to Asia doesn't really happen under Obama. Trump comes in recognizing the depth of the problem, and he's also got a whole foreign policy team of old school protectionist cold warriors, but also a section of the capitalist class that thinks he's out of his mind, but they can use him for their own ambitions. So he comes in and shifts the strategy away from the war on terror, away from the Middle East, ending the forever wars, and putting an America first foreign policy of really abandoning the multilateralism that had been a core part of the U.S. imperial project since World War II for a unilateral assertiveness, protectionism in economics, and a transactional relationship with all states, including close allies of the United States. There's an element of a recognition of a problem and an absolutely reckless strategy that goes along with it. Because instead of cohering a project to force China to heal, which was the ambition, it blows up in his face. So the U.S. emerges discredited from the Trump administration, isolated by his racism, xenophobia, lack of trustworthiness, and the pandemic and the recession that Trump oversees also undermine the credibility of the U.S. even more. And then enter Biden, who I think has got the smartest set of imperial strategists that we've seen in a while, cohering around him, and people are not paying attention to that.
So America First is a defensive sort of move. It looks aggressive, but in a sense, its essence is defensive. It's a lashing out. And there's a reworking going on. My feeling, I can't substantiate this in any way in argument or in empirical evidence. My feeling actually is that despite all the challenges that the US now faces, and this must be the most serious challenge to the United States since it's become the world hegemon, you know, at the end of the Second World War, like the rise of China I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But the thing with the Cold War, it was that you had a whole section of the world, and I think it's important to remember that the bloc politics of the Cold War, where you had the Eastern Bloc led by the Soviet Union, the Western Bloc led by the United States, and then the nominally unaligned, although obviously aligned in various ways at various times, the non-aligned bloc or the Third World, et cetera. The non-aligned bloc was the largest in terms of just simply the number of countries involved. And as I mentioned earlier, the ability for the US to lead wasn't simply based on its own sheer power, although that was necessary. It was also necessary that there was an objective and an opposition in the Soviet Union that could give coherence to a Western alliance, give it a purpose in which everybody felt that the US leading was still of benefit to them. Everyone was going to enjoy the fruits of a US-led order against the Soviet Union. The US in, we mentioned at the start, we've been talking about the crisis of US imperialism now for coming on 20 years. But with the rise of China, do you get a sense that there is an opening, putting aside the financial system, putting aside the military might and the usual metrics of imperial power, do you get a sense that there's a possibility now of a new Western alliance that is driven not simply by US decree, but by a shared perceived common interest among a whole range of countries, not all of them Western countries, but to unite and line up and form a bloc against the rise of China? That previously the United States may have had misgivings about China's accelerated growth, but it wasn't really getting this hearing about it. But we seem to see now, and I think in particular the question of the declaration of that the Chinese government is committing genocide against the Uyghurs, which I have no doubt is true, but the use of this by a number of countries now coming together in a bloc of opposition and starting to put sanctions on this country, could we be seeing the rise of a new bloc politics, not identical to the Cold War, but a new set of alliances at which the United States is viewed as more important an ally than perhaps it has been in the last 20 years to a number of Western countries?
Yeah. Well, first, I think it's very important to underline that the U.S. empire is not about to collapse. It is by far the most powerful state in the world system, economically, geopolitically, and militarily. It has a huge advantage, and it has set up this whole system of institutions for trade, for geopolitics, and for the military that give it a tremendous opening. So I think that's important to underscore, and China is very much a rising rival and is smart that it is not in a position to directly confront the United States at all at this moment on almost anything. And so just look at what has been done to Huawei by the United States. I mean, like the bans have really hammered Huawei as a corporation, and the U.S. has done that to several other Chinese corporations. So the U.S. is still in a position of dominance. However, I think that's such a peculiar moment because all these states and economies are utterly integrated. Look at Apple. Apple doesn't make anything Apple doesn't make anything. Apple just designs does the science and the high-tech research, but it subcontracts all the manufacturing to a Taiwanese corporation that makes the iPhone, et cetera, in China. And so we wouldn't have iPhones anywhere on the planet without the giant factories that Foxconn runs in China. So you still have this massive integration of these state rivals, which tends to mitigate the dynamics of an over clear block forming with the US neatly geopolitically and economically on one side with its allies, and then China with similar states on its side. And China wants to avoid that right now at all costs, because it will only stand to lose. It stands to benefit by the integration. So I think that you can see the patterns of what Biden is trying to do. But I think there's always been a contradiction since the rise of China in the U.S. Imperial strategy. And a couple of political scientists came up with a term to describe it. They called it congagement. That is a combination of containment and engagement that recognizes the interpenetration of the economies, but the need to contain this China as a potential state rival of U.S. imperialism. So if you look at what Biden's doing, there's a very smart strategy that's drive. This is the smartest strategy of any of the administration so far to deal with China. Number one is turn away from neoliberalism to Keynesianism, at least in a beginning way, with the stimulus and then this massive infrastructure plan, because the U.S. cannot dominate the world if it has feet of clay at home. So it needs to redevelop its infrastructure, railroad, railway, airports, high-tech infrastructure, research and development. So a big investment of that domestically, and then re-engaging with the alliances that that Trump had so alienated, and banding them together, but not to simply block China out of the world economy, but to pressure it to obey U.S. rules. And I think the weaponization of human rights is a key part of that project. I don't think that Joe Biden really cares that much about the Uyghur population. He cares about bullying China to accept U.S. rules. So I think he's trying to band the democracies, quote unquote, together against China to build a bloc to pressure China to follow the rules. And if China doesn't follow U.S. dictates, to be in a position to more aggressively dictate. But they don't want to do that straight up, because of the level of integration. And Biden is also holding out the possibility of collaboration, too. And so it's actually well thought through strategy that Biden is developing, in which you have domestic reform tied to reassertion of U.S. imperialism abroad to deal with the fact of this rivalry. So I don't think yet we have anything like a bloc because of the level of integration. So it's a very complicated rivalry because of the interpenetration of the economies.
Okay, well, within that comprehensive response, Ashley, I think everybody here will have heard the key answer to the question that was on everyone's lips, that your empire, according to you, is not on the verge of collapse. We have been going for a little while, so
We're going to go back to Ben, and then Ashley will get the final word. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, thanks. Just a couple of things from me. I mentioned the phrase or something like, you know, thinking about the return of bloc politics. Maybe that is the wrong way to frame it, just because it conjures forth a vision of the past in a world that has been so fundamentally transformed in its integrations now. Perhaps a better way of thinking about it is like trickle-down imperialism. And I think everyone's heard about trickle-down economics, I imagine. Though we rubbish it, there is actually an element of truth in trickle-down economics. There is a trickle-down. It's only a trickle. That's the main point of it. But the Cold War was, I think, an experience of what you might call trickle-down imperialism, in the sense that there were trickle-down tangible benefits for those who were part of the ruling classes that tied themselves to the US alliance. They saw benefits in allowing the US to lead and allowing the US to station its military bases all, you know, in their own countries, Japan, Germany, pretty much all around the world. The United States built up its apparatus everywhere. You get a sense that in some ways that many of these countries then in a unipolar moment were trapped in the architecture of the global economy that the US had created We're still, the ruling classes were still benefiting, but it, obviously the geopolitical sense of alignment was fracturing. And I think if we think about it now, you can see elements or aspects of the beginnings of a new trickle-down imperialism coming to the fore simply because of the rise of China. And obviously it is different. Omar mentioned that, well, and Ashley did as well, actually a few people did, that the question of the integration of China with the United States economy is very different to the situation of the Cold War when you have a rivalry in which one of the blocs is simply a major bloc that has basically hermetically sealed itself off from the rest of the world economy. That's both an incredible strength for the rulers of the Soviet Union in that their economy has far lower levels of labour productivity than the West. So sealing itself off with the Iron Curtain allows it to maintain its own economic and territorial integrity without having the as Marx called them, you know, the battering rams of the commodities of global trade coming down and ruining its own industries. Obviously, the weakness of the Soviet Union in being hermetically sealed off was that the Western countries, in particular the United States, was able to take advantage of the growing international trading system, the growing international financial system, to generate levels of growth that in the end were much higher than the Soviet Union, and was able to put it out of business through an arms race in which the Soviet Union couldn't compete and ended up collapsing under the weight of its own contradictions. Whereas now, when you do have the return of, you know, inter-imperialist rivalry of the level that we have, but you don't have an hermetically sealed off rival, you have a rival that is thoroughly integrated into all of the architectures of global trade and global trade that were set up to benefit the Western powers. So any move by one country against another now is not like making a move against the Soviet Union. Any move by the United States against China and vice versa in the economic field necessarily affects the person doing the moves. And we've seen that with the application of tariffs by the Trump administration, which, you know, from which he bragged that the United States was making billions of dollars. But anybody that was looking at it could see that the consequences of putting on tariffs on particular industries was flowing over into the United States' own domestic industries via other channels. So the competition at the heart of the global imperialist projects it has a thoroughly different dynamic, which is unpredictable, but still pushes towards the setting up of alliances. I guess the unknown for me, which I throw up, is how we conceive that these may look in even a decade's time, when you don't just have that hermetically sealed block of the East against the block of the West in the Cold War, but rather this sort of integrated competition in which zero sum in the economic sphere as well as the diplomatic sphere and political sphere. So I'll hand over to Ashley.
Great. Thanks for all the contributions, and thanks, Ben, for the questions. And thanks to Comrades and Socialist Alternative for inviting me. I wish I could be there in person, or you guys could be in the States and we could hang out, and hopefully the pandemic will end soon so we can do that and really build the bonds of solidarity among international socialists. I just have a few responses to some of the questions, which were great, and I can't go into great deal with all of them. I think what Omar says is very important about the Great Recession and its differential impact on different sections of the world economy and the states that run those sections of the world economy, that there's no doubt that the Great Recession hammered Western capital the most severely, and that Europe was in particular devastated more dramatically than the United States even, and has recovered in a more weak fashion than the United States. The United States, though it has recovered and has had higher growth rates than the European Union, it's still the weakest recovery and that the U.S. has had after a major crisis on record. So it's a very, very weak recovery. The economy that managed to come out of that recession and actually got strengthened was China. It pressed its advantage. And so I think that's what's brought the problem of China into sharp relief for the last two administrations. And that I think is important to come to terms with. And both in the United States and in China, the foreign policy establishment is thinking about how to handle this reality. The U.S. is devising its own strategy, which I'll talk about more in just a second. But China, as Omar said, is rightly thinking about what its strategy is to deal with the contradictions of being integrated with your rival. Because I think that's how to understand, like Omar said, the holdings of U.S. U.S. money in the Chinese system. It's both a position of power because the U.S. can't bully China, but it's also an expression of its dependency on U.S. export markets. So both things are true, and it's part of the contradiction of integration among rivals. But China is really beginning to think about more intensive development so that it can increasingly have a market of its own within the country. But I think that's a problem because it also is utterly dependent on these export markets for this huge productivity of its economy. And that's why you see it continuing the Belt and Road Initiative to try and integrate whole sections of the world economically with China, as well as the, you know, more internal intensive development. So I think that's its strategy, is both in develop its capacities and including its market internally, but also continue its participation in the world system. In contrast to that, I think with the Biden administration, I just wanted to flesh out a little bit more about what Biden is up to, because what Chloe was saying about the turn toward industrial policy is extremely important. And I didn't have a chance to really flesh this out. Everybody should read the Biden, Blinken, Campbell, and Sullivan. It sounds like a grouping of little elves, but they're actually a very, or dwarves, I guess it's the closest thing to the dwarves. And but they really have been talking about how to deal with China for a while, and it is definitely the beginnings of a departure strategically from neoliberalism as a strategy. And they've laid it out in many, many print articles, and you can hear it daily from especially Blinken and Sullivan targeting China as their main competitor. And so they've laid out what they want to do. They want to overcome the pandemic, which Biden is aggressively pursuing, even to the point of, you know, not exporting vaccines so that the U.S. Population can be vaccinated and we can get the hell out of this disastrous pandemic so that they can get the economy running at full tilt. Their turn to Keynesianism is dramatic. The stimulus spending and the infrastructure bill. They're talking about an infrastructure bill of as high as $10 trillion, which is not as big as the previous state investments like the New Deal, but it's still a dramatic increase and a new project. And it's not just roads and bridges. It's higher education. It's industrial policy to develop more effective high-tech champions for the United States. And there's a big reason for that is they know that the new military confrontations are going to be especially in high-tech. So they have to have mastery of the high-tech and robotics and et cetera, so that they can have weapons for the future. And they have to make sure their supply chains militarily are in spheres that they trust and also increasingly back in the United States. So there is a real commitment to onshoring at least chunks of the strategic American supply chains. And then the final thing is trying to bandwagon alliances together in what they call a league of democracy and weaponize human rights against China. So they definitely have a plan, and there is certainly massive confusion on the U.S. left about how to respond to it, because much of the U.S. left, including in DSA, has been very focused on domestic reform and not thinking about international politics. And if you look at international politics, when you listen to Sanders and Biden, there's not a big gap rhetorically or strategically in what they say, but people have had their eyes off the prize of the dynamics of the world system, and in particular, the U.S. China rivalry. And then I'll just end with what this means politically for the international left. There is no doubt we are in a new kind of situation. The unipolar moment is gone. We do have this asymmetric multipolar world order. There are many states that are jockeying for position in the world. The U.S. is dominant, but it faces a real potential peer competitor in China's rise as a global capitalist power. And that produces the dynamic of inter-imperial rivalry. But it's taking place in a different circumstance where you have this high level of economic integration, which tends to mitigate open military confrontation and displace it into geopolitical and geoeconomic conflict, or less so in terms of military conflict. But there are flashpoints, and there are some flashpoints that are of immense strategic significance, one of them being Taiwan, another being Hong Kong, where you have the U.S. and China at loggerheads. I do not think, at least in the short term, this will produce any kind of giant war at all. I don't think we're on the edge of anything like that. But there are dynamics that are quite scary of the U.S. positioning its military around Taiwan, promising all sorts of weapons deals to Taiwan, and China increasingly flexing its muscle. But both sides want to avoid a confrontation. And I think that's the underlying dynamic. It's more jockeying and sending signals, imperial signals to one another about what they're willing to do. But, you know, there are unforeseen dynamics where accidents do happen and they can detonate much more scary things. But I think in the short term, because of the integration of the two powers, it mitigates any open conflict. And also the fact that they're both nuclear powers mitigates open conflict. So I think there's a protracted period of jockeying in geopolitics and military, but increasing geoeconomic competition between the U.S. and getting its allies together to confront China. And I think that just underscores the importance of international socialism, because at least on the U.S. left, there's real confusion about how to explain this situation, and there's a really nasty development within the U.S. left of a kind of Cold War campism of the politics of my enemy's enemy is my friend, and siding with China against the U.S. because of the history of American imperialism and its predatory nature. And I think international socialism is absolutely essential, because we provide an alternative where we can oppose our own imperialism full stop, but not line up with rival imperial powers in this dog-eat-dog fight for global domination, but instead build bonds of solidarity between workers across that division who have much more in common with one another than the bastards that run the states and corporations on either side of these kinds of conflicts. So the most important takeaway is build your organization, really project confidently the ideas of international socialism, and let's get to work building the international class struggle to get rid of the roots of imperialism in this goddamn rotten capitalist system and replace it with socialism.